The disclosure of White House emails is the latest twist in the controversy of how the Obama administration handled the attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi last September. Much of the debate here in Washington is over what happened afterwards and the roles of U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and President Obama. But beyond the politics, there are important lessons to be learned about what happened before and during the attack, which killed U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other Americans. Lessons about preparation, use of intelligence, interagency communication, and the chain of command. Joining us now by phone from Woodbridge in Virginia is retired Marine Corps Colonel Gary Anderson, who also served in various positions for the State Department. And good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here, Neil.
Weren't we supposed to get this thing right after 9/11, particularly the interagency communication part?
We were sure supposed to. Somewhere along the line, things sort of broke down, and it's obviously disturbing that we haven't come as far as we thought in that time.
As you looked at what happened before the attack in Benghazi, what do you think are the important lessons to be taken away there?
I think that right now it's hard to tell what the lessons are because there is no clear chain of accountability or decision making. The first question you ask yourself is who is in charge of this thing? You had a mission, a State Department mission on the ground. Theoretically, everyone in that mission, including that special operations team that supposedly could have reacted to this thing, was working for the head of mission, which in this case was the deputy chief of mission, since the ambassador was the individual involved. And it's unclear to me, even at this point, if he had the authority to launch that special operations team or whether someone outside that chain of command in the Department of Defense or in Southern Command, Special Operations Command, overruled that. And it's never become obvious to me what that chain of command was. And that, it would seem to me that would be one of the first questions to see the congressional people that are asking, doing the inquiry should have been asking.
So, in other words, had the ambassador, the head of mission, been alive, he would have been in control. But once he was dead, there was nobody in control.
Well, that's one issue. But the second issue is whether or not that special operations team was under the mission's control. If it wasn't, that decision was made in Washington. And then, in that case, all right, who made that decision and why did they make the decision? And did that come from above somebody at the desk in Washington, and so forth, and those questions have never been answered, or as far as I can tell, in the current congressional testimony, haven't even been asked. They seem to be dancing around who's to blame, rather than to try to figure out exactly what happened. That's disturbing if we're going to try to do lessons learned on this thing.
The other agency that was involved in, and there's, speaking of dancing around, is the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, the Central Intelligence Agency was, and theoretically they also were under the control of the mission. But that's, again, that's why this interagency thing becomes so muddled. Were they or were they not? And also, that special operations team, I don't think was working for the CIA. I think they were a DOD asset that I obviously was operating in support of the mission there on the ground. So who was in charge remains a question. Obviously, the deputy, from his testimony, didn't think he had the power to do that, nor was the special operations commander on the ground, able to take independent action, apparently without going back to D.C.
Mm-hmm. And
that really raises some questions that we really ought to get to before the next one of these things pops up.
There was also confusion. Ordinarily, there would have been military aircraft, Air Force planes, on call on behalf of the to support operations if the mission called, but they were too far away.
Well, I mean, again, as I understand it, they were attempting to normalize this thing, and they didn't perceive apparently that there was enough of a threat to have an overhead cover. Now, that that's best I can determine from what I can read in the after action or the things that are in the open source at any rate. So if there was intelligence that there was a threat, perhaps there would have been. But it's not clear to me if there was that type of intelligence that was ever conveyed to the people that were flying the airplanes.
And there's a belief that these aircraft can be summoned at a moment's notice. That's not actually true. I mean, they have to be sent from somewhere. There has to be refueling planes if they're going to get back home.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if in fact there was a threat overhead, they would have had some kind of mission package set up. But obviously they didn't anticipate that threat. I think they thought up until this thing went down that they actually were going back to a normal State Department mission mode. You don't have, combat aircraft flying overhead at, in any normal embassy. And I think that obviously that added to confusion, but it's not clear to me whether or not air support would have or could have helped. There is obviously a question that they might not have been able to get something there eventually to make some kind of show of force. But I think the real issue may have been if we had some assets in Tripoli that could have gotten to Benghazi to at least try to mitigate the situation, that we need to find out how that didn't happen and try to correct it the next time.
And when you're saying those assets that were in Tripoli that might have gotten to Benghazi, you're talking about that unit of four special operations troops.
Yeah, I mean, they theoretically, now this is, again, what I understand from the congressional testimony, that they were told to stand down. And the question is who had the authority to stand them down and what was the rationale? If there was a reasonable rationale that they think that they might have been, ambushed at the airport, might have been a baited trap ambush, that's fine. I mean, that's a reasonable decision. But nobody has articulated that, nor has anybody pin down the guy that actually made that decision, or if there was somebody up the line that was actually passing that decision down. And that's the in my mind, that's the unknown that's truly disturbing in this thing.
There's also the question of how much protection was there ahead of time in Benghazi, and it was a decision that they wanted to keep a small footprint, and this was apparently the interest had been expressed by the Libyan, what there was of a Libyan government.
Yep, that's a policy decision, and that's fine, based on perhaps what they knew of the intelligence at the time. But the question still remains: was there some some kind of intelligence that said that, either A, they shouldn't have been there, in which case either the ambassador made a decision that he needed to be there anyway and that he'd accept the risk, or that they just didn't know that there was the threat. And again, that's really cloudy at this point in time. And I think those are the kinds of questions that you would expect a reasonable congressional inquiry to be asking, and I haven't heard those questions asked. I'm seeing a lot of, what appears to me to be political, jockeying rather than a real serious attempt to try to find out what's wrong and then take action to fix it.
Have you read the report that was put out by Ambassador Pickering and former chairman of the Joint Chiefs Mullen?
I've read the excerpts of it, and again, it didn't, it didn't connect the dots in my mind.
There's another question that a lot of people ask, and we've had Ambassador Pickering on, and he's answered it, but let me ask it to you. Why is it that those missions in very dangerous places were not protected by U.S. Marines?
Well, first of all, it's not normal for a consulate for protection of the Marines to extend that far down, unless you're sending in, if there's a known crisis, you're sending in a fleet assistance counter-terrorist team, what the Marines call a FAST team. But in this case, if they're in a normal consulate, even in Herat, where I was in Afghanistan last year, we didn't have Marine protection at the consulate, so we had them, at the embassy. They're generally there to protect the inner sanctum of the embassy. They're not there to provide exterior support outside the embassy and so forth. That's usually a host nation responsibility. So I think the issue is not so much why weren't there Marines there. The question is, did you know, should we have been in that particular posture in that particular place? And I don't have the answers to that.
And when you
but
say,
I think somebody ought to try to find out.
And when you say protect the inner sanctum, their job is to protect secrets rather than necessarily personnel.
Yeah, the embassy guards, it's kind of a, you know, a misperception. They in any embassy, they essentially protect the chancery and the embassy and the ambassador's residence itself, and particularly to, you know, you get them into a safe place if there is an attack, or if that fails, to destroy the classified material and so forth. They're not responsible for the overall external or internal security of the embassy compound per se. They can augment that, and they have if necessary. But there's a diplomatic security mission that does that sort of thing. And then, obviously, which didn't happen in this case, you're hoping that you've got a competent external protection from the host nation, which is responsible for the safety of the, you know, the entire compound.
We're talking with retired Marine Colonel Gary Anderson about lessons learned from before and during the attack in Benghazi. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And any number of recommendations were made by the Pickering-Mullen report. As you look at those, are they going to address the kinds of interagency communications problems that you're worried about?
You know, that's a good question. And I think that until we figure out exactly what that chain of command issue was, and if they address that in that report, it escaped me. But how that, you know, how that internal communication between the DoD assets, the CIA assets, and the State Department assets worked, before you really answer those questions, I don't think you can make really coherent recommendations. Yeah, you can, you know, you can once again try to get better fusion of information than apparently we had in this case. And that's really closing the barn door after the horses are gone. But I don't understand how we can fix the problem unless we know really where the problem truly lies.
And in terms of addressing the problem, though, as you said, you've worked in places like Herat. You also worked in Baghdad and various other interesting places. Should there be a formula? Should it be decided on a case-by-case basis?
Well, I think, amazingly enough, and I've been in Iraq and Afghanistan working with the State Department, and diplomatic security there has been, in my view, pretty good. Sometimes as a field operator, I have problems. I thought that they had a tendency to err on the side of caution, but obviously in this case, the caution was warranted. But I've never had any doubt in my mind that they had in Iraq and Afghanistan that they had coherent plans, because they were essentially high-risk posts where you're essentially giving people hazardous duty pay and everything else. I think in Libya, unfortunately, I think we were in the process of transitioning to a more business-as-usual mode, and that level of security obviously wasn't in place at that point in time.
Well, I mean, I'm asking, should there be a set rule in every situation? The ambassador, the State Department is in charge, and if the CIA is there, they have to report to the State Department,
yeah,
DOD?
Absolutely. I think there's no two ways about it. I think you've got to have unity of command. And if the ambassador has the assets and the guy on the ground, the military guy on the ground, says we can do the mission, or we can at least attempt the mission with a reasonable degree of risk, the ambassador ought to be able to make that call. That's what he gets paid for. And if that option was not available to the ambassador or his designated chief of mission, then we've got a problem. So, yes, the answer to your question is yes. So there should be one guy in charge on the ground in that country.
And then there's the question of post-attack, where there was apparently some conflict between the FBI trying to investigate things and the CIA.
Well, again, that's gets right back to the 9/11 thing. I mean, this is what we were supposed to have solved. This is clearly an operation that was overseas, which is usually in the CIA's jurisdiction. The FBI does criminal investigations better than anybody. But again, at some point in time, if you've got a stovepipe there where the two agencies aren't talking to each other, either in Washington or on the ground, you've got a real problem. And there's not an excuse for it 12 years now after 9/11. This is supposedly should not be rocket science, but somehow it becomes it.
And to solve it, is this executive order or is this something Congress has to get involved in?
Well, this is where, the interagency problem gets to be really, really challenging because, if you look at the Constitution, every head of agency, if the guy on the ground goes all the way up to his head of agency, they only report to the president. So obviously it's got to be something that the executive authority does, and he has got to delegate that authority if he's not willing to sit there and handle every crisis that comes down the pike. He has got to delegate it to somebody on the ground who can say, do this thing. I don't care, I don't want you talking to your agency back home. You're working for me. Do it.
Gary Anderson?
If that's not happening, then I think we're going to have a continuing problem.
Gary Anderson, thanks as always for your time.
Good talking to you, Neil.
Retired Colonel Gary Anderson. Tomorrow, Victor Davis Hanson and General Bernard Traynor on the war in Korea. Join us for that. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.